I'd like to get my email address out again. M2EO, my call letters, at yahoo.com. I am concerned about safety. I think Joe said most people in the U.S. are not. I am. And to answer what George's question, it's a question whether we're all fell or not. I'd like to stay here. The problem is I need a lot of work. The only people coming by are investors that want to buy the property, fix it up, and resell it. And they're not offering me enough money. So I figured if I fix the house up, I can either stay here if I wish, if I can, or sell the house at a good asking price. Either way, I win.
Yeah, I think for the time being, you've decided to stay for a while. Okay, Rich, WB2GXM. Are you still there, Rich? K2LIW. Okay.
Sushi.
We're getting a little bit late, so try to keep it brief, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to go to something easy. But we're going to keep it brief. The circulators, the circulators that use ferromagnetic material instead of just a magnet, rare earth magnets, and some of them work at resonance frequencies. If you've heard about it, you can say a few words.
Yeah, the radio frequency circulators that I'm familiar with have a combination of a gyrotropic material, a ferrite-like material, set up in a Y-like configuration of a printed circuit board with some of this ferrite material above and below the tri-plate strip line with a biasing magnet, an Alnico or something like that, or a neodymium magnet. So the combination of the magnetic field and the gyrotropic ferrite material gives you non-reciprocity. In other words, the signal going around that circuit clockwise goes at one velocity. The signal going around that circuit counterclockwise goes at another velocity. Therefore, when it's properly set up, input to pin number one comes out of pin number two. Nothing comes out of the terminated port number three. Any reflected signal coming back into pin number two, the normal output, gets circulated to pin number three, the dummy load. And therefore, from your point of view, from the transmitter's point of view, connected to port number one, the signal flows out and nothing flows back. There's various designs for those. Some of them cover an octave, some of them are a little bit more narrowband, depending on the amount of isolation. A well-made one gives you at least 15 dB of isolation. There are specially made ones that will give you 30, 40, and 50 dB of isolation over a narrow frequency region. But there are some that will give you at least 15 dB of isolation over approximately an octave. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, how low we can go with the circulators, and a few words about coaxial circulator.
Yeah, most of these have a coaxial input. In other words, the input connectors are OSM, Type N. I don't think I've seen UHF. The circulator gets larger and larger as you go to lower and lower frequencies. You can, in theory, buy a circulator that works at 50 megahertz, but they're rare. And very frequently people don't need them down there because the transmitter is robust enough it can tolerate quite a bit of reflection. There's a way you can set up a circulator circuit with a coaxial cable. That's a hybrid. With pure coaxial cable, with no ferrite, no magnetic field, you can make hybrids. You can't make a circulator out of that, in my opinion, if that's what you're asking. N2XJN, K2LIW.
About 10 years ago, there was something that's being called electronic circulator, and was the debut of it, which could work as low as 50 kilohertz. You can simply Google circuit forms low frequency circulator, and it's on microchips using National Semiconductor microchips. Let me just.
Yes, you can make circulators if you're willing to put in amplification, if you're willing to put in well-balanced amplifiers, particularly with, a Keurig-Kaur circuit. With amplifiers, you can electronically make a circulator that covers a zillion octaves, but a passive circulator requires magnetics. Over to you, West.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now, there is a little confusion because if we have a light due to Faraday effect, we could bend the light. And I had a question, can light propagating through the medium be influenced by the application of the external magnetic field and why?
I don't understand the question. Over to you, Wes.
Well, the light is an electromagnetic wave and it's photon. We know that photons are massless and should go through the straight lines, travel through the straight lines. So the question is, can light propagating through a medium be influenced by the application of an external magnetic field?
I don't know. I haven't worked with enough optical circuits to be able to answer that. Over to you.
Yes, it can due to the Faraday effect, but I'm not going to go deeper because everybody's going to be bored with it. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Okay. We've gone down our list of people who signed in who wanted to make comments or ask questions, so it's time we go over to Roy. AC2GS has got us a great puzzle tonight. K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dick. And hello to everyone here. As always, want to remind everyone that if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any refutations, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And any and all stories that I talk about tonight will be posted about 5-10 minutes after I'm done. On a webpage, you just have to type in your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll see those links. So let me drop for a second and tweak some settings, and I'll be right back.
Dick, if you're interested, I have an amusing comment. Very amusing.
And Dick, after that's done, I have a question. AC2PL.
Okay, I'm back again, a little confused. Thought the initial episode of the TechNet was done and it was the science to talk, but I leave it up to you, Dick, what you want to do about that. Okay, I'll take that as going on with the science talk. If you have any science questions, you can ask me. I'll try my best. If not, I have a couple of very small little puzzlers that hopefully people will be entertained by, and we can chat about them for a little while before I get to the stories. One question I have for the audience is, and keep in mind, unfortunately, we might have semantic problems because definitions kind of mean different things to different people, but what do you think is the most massive organism alive today?
W2ASC.
Yes, what do you think?
I recall reading something about a gigantic fungus that spans several hundred square miles somewhere in the United States. I don't recall what, but this goes back a ways. That would be my guess off the top of my head.
AC2IS comment.
Yes, Bill.
that's a type of mushroom where the what we see above ground is actually part of sort of a large underground organism. I think that's what the previous person was talking about, and I think that's probably the correct answer. AC2IS. I'd also like to talk about quantum mechanics a little bit, if you don't mind. AC2IS.
Yeah, sure, Bill. I mean, we should be over with this relatively soon, so we can jump to any other question. One of the problems with this question, unfortunately, is sort of what you define an organism as, because theoretically, I guess, you could say that a colony of algae floating in the ocean could be thought of as an organism, even though separate bits and pieces of it die and new parts take their place, because in the human body, you know, every 4 or 5 years, a significant portion of the cells in your body from 7 odd years ago is a different cell. Some of them have a much longer longevity. We talked about that before in the brain and other places that last your entire lifetime. But a lot of there is turnover. So, you know, if the muscle, say, in your right arm turned over in the last 4 or 5 years, is it still your arm or is it a different person's arm? So that's a semantic type of difference. So, yeah, there are a lot of kind of colonial and cloned organisms that fit this type of an answer. The fungus is one of them. There is a aspen tree that has clones that grow as far as 5 miles across. I think that's at Fish Lake National Forest. So there's a series of very, very large, very simple, somewhat organisms. So let's kind of change it up a little bit. Let's just go to animal life. Any guesses on what might be the largest animal? When I say animal life, I mean, you know, mammals, fish, those sort of things. Not simple trees or organisms.
AC2IS, comment.
Yes, Bill.
The two obvious things that come to mind, elephant and whale. AC2IS.
Very good, Bill. As a matter of fact, you kind of answered the next question as well, which is nice. The blue whale is a ridiculously large thing. They had a specimen that was, I believe, 91 feet in length. They weighed it to 209 tons, which is a heavy, you know, rather massive thing. They have sighted a 110-foot blue whale, but they haven't gotten around to measuring him yet. I guess at that size, it's more difficult. So the blue whale is probably the most massive animal life around. If you're talking about the largest living land animal, you would be right with the elephant. It's much, much lighter. Land elephants tend to run something like 13, 14 tons. So that's significantly, that's more than about, you know, one-tenth of the mass of a blue whale. So on the same note, as long as we're kind of doing this thing about the biggest things, I thought I would throw in the most long-lived organisms. And again, unfortunately, you could make a case for how colonies live for almost ever because they simply replace the parts through time. But we'll try and narrow it down to complex organisms that don't sort of fit as simple colonies of cells. So anyone with a guess of what the oldest thing alive today might be?
AC2PL, Joshua Tree?
Well, I mean, you're biblically close. There's something called Methuselah. It's a Great Basin bristlecone pine that said, they counted the rings, it's 4,850 years old.
AC2PL, happy to be incorrect.
There are also cypress trees that have been dated to somewhere vaguely between 4,000 and 5,000 years. And the yews is the oldest tree in Europe. The great basin bristle cone pine is in North America, but the yews are in Europe, and they too have been dated somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 years. But let's move away from plants. Anyone want to hazard a guess of a non-plant that's lived a very long life?
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley.
Jellyfish is forever. Bacteria would be one of the candidates. There's something for the seagrass. Let's exclude the seagrass. Bacteria. So the jellyfish and the bacteria.
AC2PL turtle.
Okay, that's darn close. But Wes, as I said, we were trying to stay away from simple-celled or colony organisms. And jellyfish is a real semantic trip, because what happens with jellyfish is they can cycle from mature to immature to mature to immature back and forth again. And breed along the way, and then I would assume they eventually, although they pass away, it's more, and I've read the articles that you read where they say they're immortal because they can kind of go back into a premature stage. I don't think anyone's actually taken the trouble of keeping a jellyfish alive for 1,000 years to sort of prove that concept.
ACTRIS comment.
Yes, Bill.
I'm actually not sure if Wesley mentioned this. He said something, a word that sounded like this. But I was going to guess, in addition to turtles, I was going to guess tardigrade, ACTIS.
Tardigrades aren't particularly, to my knowledge, long-lived, but then again, you have to worry about the semantics involved. The beauty of tardigrades are that they're sturdy little things, that you can dehydrate them and send them into space and do whatever you want and then bring them back and rehydrate them, and they seem to come back into living. They're very, very sturdy. So you can put a tardigrade into what amounts to suspended animation for decades and then resuscitate them. I don't think that means necessarily that if you take a tardigrade and you don't put him into suspension and you just wait long enough, I think it too dies.
WS2N, alligator.
What was that, Paul? It sounded like Halyear.
Alligator, you know, crocodile, one of those things.
Okay, yeah, alligator. They live somewhat long, but the closest answer that really works in this particular case. Well, there's another answer that kind of fudges things a little bit. Glass sponges apparently found in the East China Sea in the Southern Ocean have been found to be over 10,000 years of age. Now, you might want to consider the glass sponges as an animal. You might say it's a colony. I don't know. But it's the Aldabra giant tortoise. There was one that lived to an estimated age of 255 years. It died March 2006 in India. So that's probably the oldest terrestrial animal that's recorded in the books. Anyone want to hazard a guess what the oldest living human being was, what the record is?
I mean that there's an Iceland shark, which is over 200 years, and one of the oldest is a Red Sea urchin.
JXN with a guess.
Okay, guess away, Rich.
The oldest living human being was 115 years.
Hey, that's a good guess. Anyone else with a good guess?
AC Joyous, I am guessing 125.
Okay, you're both circling that magic number of this woman's age.
145, but I didn't know it. I just read it. Maba Goto from Java, 145.
Hey, one of the problems with this is, unfortunately, for this particular list that I found this information, it bases it on legitimate record keeping. Because I don't know if you guys remember, there was a yogurt commercial where the basis for the entire yogurt commercial was some East European town where everyone ate yogurt and was, you know, 240 years old. So unfortunately, and again, this is up to, you know, semantics and what have you, these are people with definite records that you can go back to and see when they were born, as opposed to asking people when they were born and being told some date.
You mean I have to throw that yogurt out?
Well, probably by now it would be a good thing. I you know, there's only so much a bye-bye date can get you.
All right.
Anyone else want to hazard a guess? Okay, Jean Calment, she lived to the age of 122 years and 164 days. And she passed away August 4th, 1997. So that's the record to break, everyone. That's it with the puzzles. Bill, you said you wanted to talk something about quantum mechanics.
Yeah. My understanding is that, you know, most of the things that I've heard about quote-unquote quantum mechanics in the past are not really mechanics, as I understand it. They seem to discuss probabilities and so forth. But recently I heard something that sounded, you know, fairly quote-unquote mechanical. That there was a particular kind of crystal, I forget the name of the crystal, that they could take a whole bunch of photons streaming out of the sun, run it through this crystal, and every once in a long while, I don't know how many photons would strike this crystal, and instead of getting the one photon out of the original energy, you get two photons of a lower energy level, and that somehow these two photons of a lower energy level would have all the same quantum properties. Does this sound familiar at all? And is this introducing some actual mechanics into quantum mechanics? And, I mean, if so, this is really the first I'm hearing about it. AC2IS.
Well, Bill, you know, as far as I know, it's the loosest term for mechanics, which is any mathematically derived equations that have to do with motion and forces producing any kind of emotion. So they're using mechanics, unfortunately, very, very, very loosely. But you are quite right in what you read about. That's called quantum entanglement. We actually covered that particular article. It was a story. There's different ways to quantumly entangle objects. And one way that you quantum entangle photons is to run them through certain optical crystals that kind of act like a splitter, in which you can have optical crystals that act as mixers, too. The blue light-emitting laser pointer that most people use, if you look at it optically, what's going on really is you have a laser that's producing infrared. It's going through a doubler crystal, and the two photons are summing together, mixing, and giving you that blue laser light. And the same way that you can combine them, you can also find optical crystals that split them. But about one every million or 10 million photons will go through it and be split, but be quantum entangled, so that they're some aspects of their quantum numbers are identical. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all identical. Usually, quantum entanglement people don't really discuss the fact that that could be just one quantum number that the two are entangled. There's something called super entanglement, which probably gives people super headaches, where more than one quantum number is kind of linked together for the two particles. So that's a legitimate thing. They've been working with those crystals down on Earth, and they decided to use it for light from the sun to see if they could quantum entangle photons from the sun instead of from the Earth. So you're quite right about that. I don't know if that really fulfills the concept of mechanics, but quantum entanglement by these interesting types of crystals, one of them I think is a barium oxide crystal, does exist. And they've used it and they've reported on it.
I'm going to let the repeater drop for a second and come back. This is AC2IS again. So my understanding is that with these entangled particles, you can sort of run them through a beam splitter and be guaranteed that your two entangled particles are going to take the same path through the splitters, through a splitter, I believe. Normally, I guess you'd run light through a splitter and you'd get some, random sampling, some percentage in one direction, some percentage in the other. And here the entangled particles will always go in the same direction. So that implies to me that there's some kind of mechanics involved, right? I don't know that they can determine absolutely, what are the quantum properties of the particles, but, it sounds like there's something, quote-unquote, mechanical going on there, AC2IS.
Okay, the experiments that I'm aware with most quantum entanglement experiments are not for locations of paths, because you couldn't really tell if they had the same quantum number or they were going in the same direction. There's no way to really measure it much one way or the other. What usually, something in my understanding of most of the quantum mechanic quantum entanglement experiments relate to other aspects of a photon, such as its polarization angle. So you have a photon that has you have a photon, you put it through a barium oxide crystal. It splits to two quantum entangled ones, and you do experiments manipulating the polarization of one of the photons, and the other one responds along with it, even though they're physically not connected. So there's a big problem with entanglement about locality. Physicists really would like things to happen because they're next to each other, not because they're far away from each other, and God forbid they happen instantaneously. So that's mostly what these quantum entanglement experiments are measuring. They're measuring quantum numbers, not directions of motion, at least to my understanding.
Okay, so I guess we're talking about different experiments there. I guess that both of these things sound like some sort of mechanics. I don't know that the experiment that I was talking about had anything to do with action at a distance, just that the entangled particles would behave in the same way instead of in sort of a probabilistic fashion, which, again, to me just sounds like something very much more definitive and much more mechanical than everything else I've heard about quantum mechanics, which all seems very probabilistic. Not sure what the practical outcome is of any of this. some people say that quantum computers are around the corner and that this is somehow going to make for a large leap in computing and would somehow be able to break cryptography. I don't understand any of that. But this is, I think, something that I could at least wrap my head around a little bit. AC2IS.
AC2PL query. PL. I have a question about group delay.
Hey, one sec. Let's just finish up with Bill. I sort of realize that quantum mechanics generally is kind of highly theoretical. It has to do fundamentally with the idea that everything is some aspect of a wave. So everything is defined. Schrodinger's equation is basically just a wave equation for particles. And then, unfortunately, you have to square it to get the probability factor of where things are. So it gets deeply confusing. And most quantum mechanics doesn't easily translate to the macro world of velocities, motion, and how things work, unfortunately. They tend to exist. They're emerging properties in the macroscopic when there's billions and billions of interacting quantum mechanical particles doing their thing. So it can be problematic, and with the exception of things like transistors, which are based on quantum mechanics, you can't build or you can't rationalize how a transistor works, or even things like superconductors without quantum mechanics. Generally, the laws of motion and such are easily answered either in the macroscopic with Newtonian physics, or in the case of very large or very massive things, with relativistic equations. But I can understand why you would have that sense that quantum mechanics is kind of nebulous.
This is AC2IS again. One other thing I just unrelated heard recently was that apparently the speed of gravity is now known to be the same as the speed of light. And I guess then we'll move on to whoever else has a question, AC2IS.
I think the easiest, if you will, way to kind of look at that is that it's nothing particularly special about the speed of light and the speed, say, of gravity, and that light equals gravity, gravity equals light, or something like that, which some people have sort of taken away with the idea. It's more of an underlying concept of space-time itself. Space-time has a speed factor. You can only traverse space-time at the speed of light. You can't do it faster. Now, you can expand space-time at any rate that you want. You can expand space-time faster than the speed of light, and that's why the universe is flying apart at a speed at the edges faster than the speed of light, simply because it's not that the things are moving through space, but space itself is expanding around it. So that's why these things are kind of stuck at the speed of light, because they're stuck going through the fabric of space-time, and space-time itself has that speed limitation, not necessarily light or gravity. So that's, you know, that's sort of what's going on. It's kind of the other way around than people kind of like to think of it, that these are separate entities, characteristics of certain things. Other objects that have much more limited velocity because they have a non-zero rest mass, they can't reach the exact speed of light. They reach it asymptotically, with more and more energy being fed into it until it would require an infinite amount of energy to get it at the speed of light. But if you have no rest energy, like photons do, then it zips across at the speed of light. And gravity, unfortunately, we're not quite sure if it's a field particle effect or if it's just a geometric effect, because Einstein kind of liked to think of gravity as simply the curvature of space-time, not an actual force. It we perceive it as a force because we can't perceive space-time or the warpage of it.
AC2ISA. Yeah, well, I think the speed of gravity was experimentally confirmed only just recently by LIGO, correct? AC2IS.
They were able to correlate the speed of the gravitational wave, which is a little bit different than gravity, but the gravitational wave was reported to LIGO at the same instant that the telescopes were able to see emissions of light going off where the neutron stars were falling into things. Unfortunately, you can't do that when there are two black holes that collide. They will produce a gravity wave phenomena, and LIGO will receive the signal, but they don't generate much in the way of a light show. You need to have something like a neutron star. So either two neutron stars colliding or a black hole and a neutron star will give you a light show. And if you correlate the time lapse between the light show and the gravitational wave reception, they're identical, and so that's how they proved that the gravitational waves travel at the speed of light.
VDH with a question.
VDH.
A thing I always wondered about, if the speed of gravity is the speed of light, doesn't that cause a problem with orbital mechanics? I mean, wouldn't that mean that the Earth is orbiting where the sun was 8 minutes ago rather than where the sun is actually now? And as for the planets further out, doesn't that throw a bigger misalignment into the orbital center of those planets? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have to kind of look at the math, but it doesn't seem to confuse the physicists that much. That, you know, the time delay is sort of minimal. It's very troublesome. Physicists really don't like what I was mentioning before of quantum entanglement, because it does have this sense of non-locality and this sense that things happen instantaneously across space-time. Physicists would really hate it if the instant that you did something, it would be visible, the cause and effect would be instantaneous. In other words, if you could snap your fingers, God forbid, and cause the sun to cease to exist, it wouldn't go black immediately because there's the speed of light, delay. The same way that you wouldn't fly off into space immediately, it would require that delay of the speed of light before you just kind of shot with whatever velocity you were going in before you were falling into the gravitational well of the sun. So although it sounds interesting to see what it does to orbital mechanics equations, my guess is it doesn't cause them too much of a headache, because they didn't even really need to bother about that when they were calculating it.
Actually, it just seems that there would be this kind of misalignment where the Earth would be accelerating towards the point where the sun was 8 minutes ago, and it just seems that could cause a kind of mechanical misalignment. I don't know, just a thought. Anyway, thanks for the answer.
You're welcome, John. I mean, there's a lot of things we sort of take for granted. A lot of people think that the Earth rotates, makes a complete rotation once every 24 hours. They don't realize that the 24 hour is sidereal. It takes into account our rotating around the sun. So, there are some things that actual aren't obvious to Joe Public, but I tend to doubt that this speed of light delay for gravity is that much of an effect, but it'll be interesting to Google it and see what I get.
AC2PL query.
And RIW with a comment. Go ahead, Doug.
AC2PL.
Oh, I was just wondering if we could talk about phase delay versus group delay.
Okay, well, that sounds more like an electrical engineering question. That's a time delay of amplitude envelopes and such. I assume you're asking it in terms of electrical engineering?
Oh, negative. I'm asking it in terms of time travel, like you guys are talking about with the entanglement.
Okay, what's your premise?
It's naive, but the premise is that if the envelope appears before the input, then that's sort of like time travel.
Okay, but you have to kind of, again, unfortunately, it becomes almost a semantic argument. The semantics boils down to that information cannot reach a certain point faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Although you can have the envelope reach faster than that, it can't convey any information that's useful. So that's the get around for why the speed of light is better defined as the speed limit of causality and of information transfer than anything else, because there are ways to sort of get around that speed by not placing any information in that object that you're accelerating.
But as I understood, I'm sorry. If the information that was being transmitted was regular, it could be anticipated by the system.
I don't know. That isn't the way that I read those types of articles. It was they kind of pounded the idea that it lacked information at that rate. The object that was reaching apparently at faster than the speed of light was not did not contain any actual information, and you couldn't really infer it because you need some kind of data. There's no such thing as hidden variables. That's one of the many things that people try to use to explain how quantum entanglement might work, that there are hidden variables, but there's been a few proofs that doesn't unfortunately exist.
Can I comment?
Wes, you can comment, certainly, but AC2PL, I think, would like to have respond.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Wes. Thank you, Roy. No, I'm very happy with your answer, and I'm very happy also with the comfort that expanding space brings to the kind of idea of faster than speed of light information transfer. So I'll let the conversation proceed, but thank you very much for taking my question. And I do have a question for Dick after the end of business here.
So let me answer.
I don't know, you want to answer something, Wesley, or you want to ask something, and is it different or is it related because Dick wanted to ask something?
Well, it's related. It's related. I want to have some fun. Roy, group velocity. Do you call group velocity the information or not?
It is not information. That's how it can be perceived to travel faster than the speed of light, because it's bereft of information.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
We might have that backwards, Roy. Phase velocity can be faster than group velocity, faster than speed of light. Apparent, but it's not real. Over to you.
Okay, I mix things up. I'm sorry, everyone. But thank you, Dick.
I got confused. Group velocity can be faster. And we're talking about the phase velocity. Dick, can you explain?
In the case of a piece of waveguide that's operating very close to the low-frequency cutoff frequency, the signal is bouncing back and forth between the two horizontal walls, zigzagging, and therefore the real information going down the waveguide is a lot slower along the z-axis than the speed of light. But the phase velocity, if you plot the phase coming out of the back end of the waveguide versus the front end, you can see a very little phase shift, and therefore the apparent phase velocity looks very, very, very fast, many times the speed of light. But but the information is not traveling there. In other words, it takes a whole lot of cycles of the input signal to finally get that signal out to the back end, which has a very little phase delay. It's a little bit similar to a wave of water crashing against the shore, almost perpendicular. In other words, the wave itself is almost parallel to the shore. And you're watching the wave break as it approaches the shore. And the breaking portion of the wave propagates along the shore of the land at a very high velocity compared to the velocity that the wave is really moving toward the shore. So it looks faster than the speed of the medium, but you cannot transmit information through it much faster. That may help a little bit, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. No, I was just a little bit confused between group velocity and phase velocity, because both of them could be slower, could be faster, and to exceed.
A negative group velocity, I'm sorry, group delay is invoked.
Dick?
I'm not sure what's being asked. In the case of phase velocity, you could use the slotted line on waveguide that's operating very close to the cutoff frequency at the low end. And the distance between the nulls will look like it's a large number of wavelengths. Therefore, and you're measuring phase velocity when you do that. And so you'd come to the conclusion the signal appears to be going down the waveguide much beyond the speed of light. It really is not. I don't know who asked the last question. I'm not quite sure what the last question was.
AC2PL is one negative group delay coefficient. It's negative coefficient of group delay, and that's one. I agree with you that it's the one that's very close to the low frequency range.
Dick?
Yeah, there are synthesized materials these days that have permittivity and resistivity that are crazy numbers. And they're starting to be used in antennas. So you can synthesize materials that have really crazy dielectric constant equivalent, negative numbers. And what does it all mean? I'm not quite sure. Back to you, Roy, KQRIW.
This all goes back to one of your favorite subjects, the metamaterials, because that's how they design these very strange pieces of equipment that seem to diffract light in the wrong way, that have a negative refractive index and such, and it's all fascinating optics. But to my knowledge, nothing at this point yet violates space-time, with the possible exception or confusion of quantum entanglement, which is a big problem. People have experiments. They do it on lab tables. It's not that esoteric and it's not that theoretical. And the times are instantaneous, apparently. So either there's some kind of non-locality going on with the universe, which is going to be very confusing, or there's something wrong with the speed limit. There are questions, answers, comments, or what have you before I do maybe one little story, because we're coming up to 11 o'clock already. Okay, this is a vaguely amusing one. A medicine imbroglio left several parents in Spain scrambling to figure out why their children were growing hair all over their bodies. At least 17 children in Spain recently started showing symptoms of what's called werewolf syndrome, or more scientifically, hypertrichosis. The Spanish Health Ministry told El País and Agence France-Presse, quote, "My son's forehead, cheeks, arms, and legs and hands became covered in hair," Angela Celeste, a mother of a six-month-old boy, told El País. Another unnamed mother told the Spanish newspaper that she felt anguish as she went from doctor to doctor trying to understand her three-month-old son's transformation. We went to a pediatrician, she said, and they told us it could be something genetic or to do with his metabolism. But we had to start going to specialists to rule out several syndromes and rare conditions, she said. The Spanish Agency of Medicine and Medical Science investigated the alarming outbreak and found that all the children had taken what their caretakers believed was a gastric reflux drug. They traced the medicine back to Pharma Quimica Sur, a pharmaceutical factory based in Malaga in the south of Spain. Let me drop for a sec. The Spanish Agency of Medicine and Medical Devices told Bob Pies that the agency determined that a bulk shipment of the gastric reflux drug came in from India, properly labeled, but when it was divided and repackaged, workers apparently used the wrong description in the material. What was labeled as gastric reflux medication, primazole, was actually minoxidil, which treats hair loss. The Pharma Quimica Sur operation was shut down a few weeks ago for its failure to meet control standards on drug production. The Spanish Agency of Medicines and Medical Services told the newspaper the factory was given 6 months to fix the issue uncovered in the Spanish Agency of Medicine and Medical Device investigation, or it will have its pharmaceutical production authorization revoked. In a statement regarding the withdrawal of the omeprazole from the market, the Spanish Ministry of Health said it expects the symptoms of hypertrichosis will be reversed following the discontinued use of the minoxidil. Parents who spoke to El Pai said that body hair has already begun to fall off, and minoxidil's most concerning side effect is heart complications now. So that's that particular story. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Your tweet, GS.
Wesley.
Okay, in terms of hair, why females don't have as much hair as the males are? Do you have a question? Do you have the answer for that?
It's a combination of things. It's primarily can be answered by saying genetics, which is the easiest way. But among other things, it has to do with hormone levels. Men secrete testosterone. Testosterone produces increased hair production across the body. Now, it doesn't do the same exact because there are other genes that modulate it. And that's why there are some very hairy men and some not so hairy men. But primarily it's genetic / that men have testosterone.
I have a problem with all of your answers. The answer of my wife, the psychologist, is attraction. So females that didn't have much of hair were more attractive, and then gene in the evolution were producing, were actually altered in females the generation to the another generation to have less hairy females. Do you agree with that?
Hey, Wesley, but that actually wasn't the question you asked. The simple question that you proposed was, why do men have more hair than women do? What you really meant to ask is, why did the human race evolve such that men have more hair than women have? And there's a whole interesting aspect of human evolution called sexual dimorphism. There are some species where the males and the females look identical. There are some species of life where the males and the females look incredibly different. We're someplace in the middle. And different racial groups have slight variations on the degree of that sexual dimorphism. So what you really meant to ask was, why were the evolutionary tendencies of evolving humanity such that men have more hair than women, which is a little bit more complicated than why do men have more hair than women?
Well, I wanted to ask the question exactly to the point, but the problem with you is that if I go straightforward, I get straightforward answer. There is no fun any longer. You have answer for any question.
Hey, Wes. Leslie, thank you for the compliment. So we answered hopefully your question, and we even discussed sexual dimorphism. You know, I don't want to kind of be a generalist here, but you know, if you look at some groups of people, Asian people, there's a slight less degree of sexual dimorphism. Men and women have very similar features to each other, but there are other groups that have a more variation. But in different species, it goes all over the place. You know, there are animals that are different sizes and different shapes and what have you. So that's an interesting concept to learn for tonight is sexual dimorphism. Any other questions or comments? I guess not. I will remind everyone once again, because it's coming up to 11 o'clock, ching hour, when we'll listen to Paul do his space report, that if you have any questions or comments or topics or suggestions or even mailbag questions for Dick, the way to get to me is through email, and the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to the story that I did about the baby werewolves will be available at ac2gs.com. And as always, I'd like to thank Dick and Paul and everyone who participated tonight, and I will turn it over to Dick so we can turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. Paul, WS2N, how's that satellite to the south pole of the moon doing? I think there's a number of unknown things there. WS2N, K2RW, go ahead with your space report, Paul.
Okay, Dick, and somebody did have a question for you, so I don't know if you wanted to pick that up before. They said when Roy got to the end. Back to you, sir.
Okay, who was that person who had a further question for me?
GXM, are you talking about the first segment, Dick?
Yeah, if you've got a brief question from the first segment, go right ahead, George.
B2GXM, Rich. Yeah, a very quick question, hopefully a very quick answer. I am using a DX60B transmitter with three crystals and one position for an external VFO. I want to use a digital VFO with that transmitter. Now, in your estimation, how much voltage do I need to drive these crystal sockets with? Can I plug this digital VFO right into the crystal socket? WB2GXM.
I'm not sure. I've done that in the past, and usually it worked. And if it doesn't, you're going to have to increase the voltage by some means. There, I'm not sure. I'm sorry to say, Rich, go ahead. Let's see if anyone else knows. A DX60 crystal socket being fed with a synthesizer of some kind. Anybody know the approximate magnitude of the signal required? Yeah, you're going to have to try it. At worst, if your signal is too weak, you'll not have full power output, and you'll know about it pretty fast. I guess you can always plug in a crystal, look at the power output, plug in your synthesizer, look at the power output, and so on. And there's probably a way you could put a resonator in there, an inductor capacitor resonator that'll act as a voltage booster, you know, an L network. So there's probably ways around it. Sorry to say, I'm not sure, Rich. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Thanks for the space. WB2GXM, turning it over to Paul.
You got it, Paul.
Very good. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And you were speaking about that satellite that went to the moon. That was from India. That was launched almost 50 days ago. And they have their own launch vehicle. Satellite launcher. The Indian government has poured a lot of money into the space program, so they have a heavy lift vehicle and a smaller vehicle for Apollo launches. So they used this one a couple months ago to launch the Chandrayaan 2 spacecraft to the moon. Their idea was to put an orbiter into a polar orbit around the moon, and then they have a lander called the Valkyrie lander, that was supposed to separate from the orbiter and land on the moon, and then on that they had a rover that was going to come out and ride around on the moon for a couple of weeks during the lunar daytime. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. You know, they got close. I got to see this live. I brought it up on YouTube. It was last Friday afternoon, like around 4 o'clock, 4:30.